We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by David Clark, Baron Clark of Windermere, who served as the Member of Parliament for Colne Valley from 1970 to 1974, the Member of Parliament for South Shields from 1979 to 2001, Shadow Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food from 1987 to 1992, Shadow Secretary of State for Defence from 1992 to 1997, and Minister for the Cabinet Office and Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster from 1997 to 1998. He's also the author of a remarkable and fascinating book, Victor Grayson, The Man and the Mystery, the subject of today's podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Lord Clark.
Hello.
So the first question that I'd like to ask is, you first became interested in Victor Grayson in the 1960s whilst studying at the University of Manchester and going to help with a by-election in Grayson's former constituency. And you talk about the book very eloquently about the sense of standing that Grayson still had in the constituency, despite having disappeared and not been the Member of Parliament for many years. Do you think that that is particularly unusual with the relationship between a Member of Parliament and their constituency?
Yes, I do. And I was really struck that when I was canvassing as a very young man, having just gone to Manchester University as a mature student, I was knocked on doors. And increasingly, a number of people said, oh, well, whoever gets elected won't be anywhere near as good as Victor Grayson. So I began to think, well, who is this Victor Grayson? I hadn't heard of it. So I went back to Manchester and dug a little bit and went back to Colne Valley again. And I was getting the same message. And it really was, I'd done a lot of canvassing, although I was very young at that time. And it just struck me that this was unusual. And I must find a bit more out about the man. And then, of course, by a quirk of fate, I ended up being the candidate, Labour candidate for Colne Valley, and eventually the MP for Colne Valley. So I was able to explore my interest. And what I found fascinating, I was managed to record a number of interviews with individuals who had actually seen Grayson, met Grayson, actually been to his meetings, and also been active in the Labour Party in his later years in the constituency. So this gave me an understanding of the man, which was, well, quite frankly, is now unique.
And one of the things that I think is interesting, and you emphasise in the book, and if you read anything about Grayson, that is clearly an important part of his appeal, was his ability to be an incredible orator, someone who could really capture an audience in the palm of his hand. Do you think that that was something that was particularly important during the early 20th century in terms of members of parliament getting elected? Because, of course, this is a time when, you know, the main means of media communication is through the written word, is through newspapers, and we don't have anything like we have today in terms of television or social media or anything like that. Do you think it was particularly important for him that he was able to stand out so much through his great speech-making abilities?
Yes, this was the key. And he really was the man of the moment at the right place in 1906, 1907, running up to the by-election in Colne Valley. Colne Valley, an unusual constituency, sandwiched in the high Pennines and their valleys between Manchester, Huddersfield and Wakefield. And it really was composed of many small industrial villages, the villages which depended on the textile industry, mainly wool in the east, mainly cotton in the west, but not uniquely so. And each of these villages were quite small, but they were self-contained. And they also were, and it was an area of, I described it, of chapels and chimneys. And that's what it was. There was a deeply held religious belief in the valley. And in comes Victor Grayson, who'd been training to become a Unitarian minister. And he knew his Christianity, and he used his Christianity in these years as part of his oratory. It was part of his mix. Mm. And whilst he was training at Manchester University to become a Unitarian minister, he got mixed up in the socialist movement, and Cone Valley was only 12 miles at the western end from Manchester University. You could easily get there by train, and he became a regular visitor. He really was the ideal candidate for that constituency at that moment of time. And he delivered the goods for socialism at that particular time.
Hmm. And you mentioned Grayson's faith there, and particularly early on in his life and in his political life, it seems to be something that was important to him and useful to him in terms of grounding his ability to make speeches and his ability to converse with people. To what extent do you think that the combination of Christianity and socialism in the early days of the Labour Party from the 1890s into the 1900s was important in convincing people to support the Labour Party instead of the Liberal Party? Do you think it was that sort of support and mixed linkage to the nonconformist tradition that really helped the Labour Party during that period, particularly in Yorkshire and Lancashire?
Yes, there was this strong nonconformist element, and it was really very important. But equally, the Church of England in these areas, I mean, these were small villages. Mm. The Church of England was composed not of posh people, not of upper middle class people, because there weren't many upper middle class people. It was composed itself of working people. And therefore, the Church of England was important. And one of the slogans, of course, that Victor Grayson used was socialism, God's gospel for today. And in the election campaign, he had occasions where he had, I think it was up to 40 ministers of religion getting together and giving their support to him. Mm. He pressed the right buttons. And of course, it was genuine. In those early days, coming from where he did in Liverpool, from a very poor working class background, he actually felt that that wasn't a fair society. His socialism was ethical as well. And it was that ethical socialism that appealed to many working class people in the industrial areas of Lancashire and Yorkshire in particular, and elsewhere.
Mm. Now, one of the things that you mentioned before Victor Grayson entered the valley is that in 1905 he was travelling around Lancashire with the Clarion van. And of course, the Clarion van and the ILP van were important means of communication for the, you know, the socialist groups at the time in order to get their message out. I mean, how comparable do you think the activities of the Clarion van are to modern day electioneering? Or do you think that they are totally of another world and very much removed from any comparison with modern canvassing and electioneering?
Well, today, of course, all the political parties are striving to find better ways to communicate with the electorate. And I think in recent years, and at this moment in time, social media is one of the key new ways forward. And of course, you might actually think of the Clarion Van movement, where people went round with the caravans being pulled by horses. This is before motor cars. And they spoke. And of course, the caravans themselves were a great. You'd go into a small village or an area and you'd tie up the horse and you'd start speaking from the front of the caravan. And it was a very personal way to actually take your message to people. And it was very effective. But I think it was, in a sense, the equivalent of the social media of today. But of course, even today, any MP or candidate worth his salt or her salt needs to be out there being seen in constituencies. So again, it forms a relationship, and people actually talk about, oh, I was in so-and-so before, and I actually saw the Labour MP, or I saw the Labour candidate, or something like that. Very, very important even today. But we shouldn't, I don't think, compare, I know you're not, the Clarion Van movement, effective as it was. And of course, in those days, the Clarion Van was connected to the Clarion newspaper, edited by Robert Blatchford, who was a very close friend, almost a father figure for Grayson, and guided Grayson through those early years until they rather fell out. But the truth was, the Clarion movement was very important, and it gave Grayson an opportunity to switch from his ethical, religious stroke socialism to a more formal and organized sense of socialism, although he never actually became what you might call a doctrinal socialist in many ways.
Turning to the by-election now, it was an extraordinary event, and it was something that really did shock British politics and shock the world in a way, politically. Just thinking about Grayson's candidature, he originally had tried to be the Labour candidate, but wasn't selected as the Labour candidate. He instead stood as an independent socialist candidate. How important do you think it was in terms of the recognition of the by-election that he didn't win the seat under the Labour standard as such?
Well, Colne Valley was unusual, let me put it that way. And of course, the trade union were very important in the emerging new Labour Party, because it was a newly formed Labour Party at this time. And the selection process was actually through trade unions plus individual members of the Labour Party, although they didn't come strong until after the First World War. So when Grayson tried to get selected, and the local people in Colne Valley, because Colne Valley was the first Labour parliamentary constituency party in the whole country in 1891. It predated the National Labour Party or even the National ILP. So, and the people of Colne Valley, the Labour activists, had heard Grayson, they liked Grayson, and they wanted him as their candidate. And they did everything they could, and Victor Grayson did as well, to try and get the nomination. But at the end of the day, the way they did it was out of order with the National Labour Party rules. So he couldn't become the Labour candidate. Now, did it affect the election? I think in 1907, Grayson would have been elected, whether he'd stood as the official Labour candidate or as he did, the Labour and Socialist candidate. He still kept the name Labour in his title in 1907. So he had the best of both worlds. And as I say, he really did captivate the local people in a way which I've never experienced before. And I must have canvassed in literally hundreds of constituencies over the past 60 years.
Mm. One of the things that I think is interesting in reading the book, and I think people will find interesting in looking back on the early history of the Labour Party, is to see a certain tension between early elements of the Labour Party, the ILP, and certain of the trade unions. It wasn't necessarily a harmonious evolution. There was some sort of at times rather bitter disagreements, and of course a lot of trade union members and trade unions still at this point were supporting the Liberal Party. Do you think that that's something that has been overlooked when discussing the early history of the Labour Party, that there is perhaps an assessment and an impression that the Labour Party and the trade unions were, completely in step in the early period, and there wasn't any real disagreement? And do you think that this is something that should be explored more, the sort of certain at particular points combativeness between the trade union movement and the early Labour Party?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very difficult relationship, because what was happening was the trade unions were providing the bulk of the money, the overwhelming bulk of the money, about 10 to 1. Whereas the ILP, the Independent Labour Party, was getting the Labour candidates, which were paid for by the trade unions. And it meant it was a lopsided sort of party. Now, the party realised that and didn't actually put it right until 1918, when there was individual membership of the party. So you could become an individual member of the Labour Party after 1918, whereas before then, you could only be a member of either a trade union or one of the few socialist parties, such as the Independent Labour Party. Very complicated situation, a lot of tension, a lot of disagreement, and it was probably the result of the war, when things, opinion changed and opinion split all parties, that things became clearer and the Labour Party realised what it had to do and did do it.
Looking at one of the slogans that was used against Grayson that you mention in the book, why does Grayson fight as a socialist? Because he cannot fight as a trade unionist. Vote for Bright. Do you think that the sort of like the separation, in a way, as you mentioned there, between the socialist movements and the trade union as the seeming lacking of alignment properly until after the war, was one of the reasons that the Labour Party did take quite a long time from its conception to entering government as a national force? Do you think if there had been a bit more of an agreement earlier on, then Labour might not have had to have waited until the 1920s to properly enter government?
Yeah, there's something in that, of course. But we've also got to think of and realise that the 40% of adult men did not have a vote, and of course, no women. So only the slightly better off working man had the vote. You had to either be a house owner or pay a rent of a certain level in order to get the vote. That was right up to 1918. And it was the change of the voting system and the widening of the franchise and the introduction of the vote for women that really gave a fillip for the Labour Party. So I think that was the key reason why Labour had such difficulty in breaking through. And of course, this caused problems in these small industrial villages because, people usually rented their houses and rents were very low. You just drive through some of these little villages today and you'll see several roads. I don't want to exaggerate the numbers because the population of these villages wasn't big, set of these villages. And the result was a large number of those families living in those houses in 1907 did not actually have the vote. And this made it very difficult for the Liberals at the end of the day, because these 40% of the voters, men, all the women, really felt aggrieved that that Liberal mill owners often had two votes. They had a vote in Cone Valley, in our case, and also a vote in Huddersfield or Oldham. I mean, it really wasn't a level playing field, and that was a great difficulty the Labour Party had to overcome.
Mm. I'd like to turn now to Grayson's parliamentary career, because as a member of parliament, he was perhaps not the most active of MPs within the House of Commons. Do you think that that was purely a result of the drinking problem which he developed over that period? Or do you think it was simply that he was perhaps more at home making speeches to people and to crowds than necessarily proposing or debating legislation within the chamber?
Well, I think it's a mixture of things. Mm. But the basic point about Grayson is he was never a man for detail. He didn't like doing committee work, much preferred speaking on the floor of the House, wouldn't actually work with colleagues or even local party people to work through things. He much preferred to do what he did best, actually, and that was to speak to people from a platform. And that he realised his great strength, and he played to it. But, I mean, it cost him dear. And I once described him as Labour's lost leader. And I think probably he could have been Labour's leader. Not at this time, but he could have been a Labour's leader after the First World War if he'd actually stuck in there, worked with the Parliamentary Labour Party, because the First World War showed the Labour Party completely split. Grayson and Blatchford of the Clarion movement were very much in favour of promoting the war. I mean, the things Grayson said about the Germans, it is quite horrible, really. But he said them. And actually, in the end, as you know, went to Australia and New Zealand and a recruiting sergeant for the British forces, and eventually joined up and, as we know, was wounded and invalided out. So I think he could have been a leader of the Labour Party, but he just couldn't bear working, doing the detailed work to bring that about. And one other thing, at this time, he also may have saved the Labour Party in a sense, because there was a move to break away from the Labour Party by many individual socialists, and then to form an independent socialist party. And Grayson was part of that, but he got outmaneuvered because he didn't go to enough of the committee meetings. And in the end, he wasn't part of the movement that went ahead, really. And the movement for an independent socialist party failed because, partly because of Grayson not really being as assiduous as he should have been. So I think a lot of it was Grayson's character.
Mentioned the First World War and his work as a recruiting sergeant and service in the New Zealand Army. Do you think that the split, as you mentioned, over the First World War was a real turning point for the Labour Party in terms of the direction that it was you know, going to go in. Do you think that the war presented a sort of like a lightning rod moment where had Labour perhaps been more united one way or the other, whether in support of the war or in complete opposition to it, that the Labour Party may not have been able to enter government in the 1920s?
I think it was important because a number of Labour parliamentarians actually played a part in the government under Lloyd George, and they gained respectability. And I think it allowed them, you look at their votes in 1918 general election, with the following election 4 or 5 years later, and they, I think, doubled their vote, so to speak. They suddenly became, people realised that it was possible for the Labour Party to govern the country. And of course, in 1923, in a very minority position, they did form a government and they struggled on for a few months. And it failed in the end, but that didn't matter because it got through to the British people that the Labour Party could govern, and their votes increased from thence onwards, right through to 1945, where Clement Attlee managed to lead a huge majority for the Labour Party that rebuilt Britain after the Second World War. They represented, they caught the mood of the time, and they were rewarded for doing so.
Mm. I'd like now to turn to one of the things that has interested people for so long about Victor Grayson, which is his disappearance. Now, I'm not going to comment on the theories that you mention in the book, simply because, you know, obviously I would encourage everyone to go out and buy the book because I think it's a fantastic read. But the one thing that I would like to ask you about is, do you think that had Grayson not disappeared, not suddenly vanished, that he would have had a significant role to play in the Labour Party of the 1920s, 1930s? Or do you think that by the time that he disappeared in 1920, that there was no real future for him in the Labour Party?
Well, he got himself into a very difficult position by 1920. No doubt about that. He had gained respect from joining up and having the courage of his convictions. No doubt about that. People respected him for that. But he had identified himself with the Conservatives, especially in this period, and I think had lost a lot of support from those of socialist inclination. It's very difficult, really, to put your finger on this. And then, as you kind of mentioned earlier, he actually did love a good life. Mm. He found it very satisfying and thoroughly enjoyed it. And, of course, he had, really from 1907 onwards, increasingly relied on whiskey. Not so much alcohol. I mean, people I've spoken to who served with him, a New Zealander I spoke to who'd served with him in the New Zealand forces, said, you could go out drinking with them, with Victor. He'd drink wine all night and not be drunk. But if he started on whiskey, he was gone. And that really was the basic problem, I think. He'd become reliant on whiskey. And the greater his disappointment in his political progress, I think, made him turn increasingly to whiskey. And we've got example of example where very keen supporters of him, like Lord Fenner-Brockway, one example whom I interviewed, and he said, I was such a fan of Grayson. Then I went to meet him with some other socialists at, in the House of Commons in about 1989, and we met him at 11 o'clock in the morning. And he was clearly drunk by that time. Mm-hmm. And I said, we didn't drink, and we just couldn't believe it. And our support for Grayson began to dissipate from that time. drink was the major problem, I think, for Grayson by 1920.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been wonderful to be able to talk to you, Lord Clark, and I have one final question. Now, of course, Victor Grayson's disappearance means that his fate is officially unknown. There were, of course, there are all sorts of competing theories as to what happened to him. But if by some strange quirk of fate, somehow, you were able to meet Victor Grayson, what do you think you would say to him if you were ever able to meet him through some sort of a quirk of time or something like that?
That's a difficult one. Mind you, I haven't done the next best thing. I became very friendly and a close friend of his daughter, Elaine, and her husband, Raymond. And I spent many hours discussing her father and what might have happened, such as we've talked today. And I also spoke to Hilda Porter, who was his landlady, and she was the last person on the September the 28th, 1920, who saw Grayson. She saw him leave his accommodation with two men, and provides us with clues. But what would I say to Victor? Well, I'm not quite sure, which I'm certain I'd tell him the stories of how I became interested in him, especially in Cone Valley, because Cone Valley is an exceptional constituency, a unique constituency. And the feeling I had in the 1960s and 70s, I'm sure he would have identified. So I'm sure we would have had personal interests and personal things to talk about then, the wonderful people there. But now, what would I say on politics? Because in a sense, I think in some ways, I'm the opposite of Grayson. Mm-hmm. I found it not difficult to concentrate on details, to serve on committees, to get into a Labour cabinet and to actually identify what I was going to do, freedom of information and actually modernising the machinery of government. That's all I did in the cabinet. But I achieved something, especially with the freedom of information, which will last for decades. So I'm so different from Victor. So I think we might have debated that. And equally, I would have admitted, look, I'm not in the same league as you when it comes to oratory. When you were on the public platform, you could have people eating out of your hands, and you did so across the country and across the world. I couldn't even compete with him, but I'd like to talk to him about it and see what he thought about modern politics as well.
I think that would have been a truly fascinating conversation. Thank you for coming onto the podcast, Lord Clark. If people want to purchase the book, where do you think they should go to purchase it?
I'm just laughing here. I think the best thing is to go onto the internet and try and get it that way. It should be available. It should be available. And I'm working hard to get it. But I think the company that produced the book has just this last week possibly gone into voluntary liquidation.
Oh.
So Quartet Books.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to make sure that the books remain available. So we'll have to see what we do, because sounds odd to say this, but I reread it, the book, and it's very kind what you said, how enjoyable you found the book. I don't know about enjoyable, but what I will say is, factually, it provides all the information that people write about today. It's all there in the book.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you very much again for coming on the podcast, Lord Clark, and hopefully you will be able to ensure that the book is widely available so that anyone who wishes to purchase a copy will be able to do so.
Yeah, we will. Thanks very much, Will.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.